We're continuing the Kuzri. We switch to an English translation. Let's see, which translation is this? Oh, they don't say what printing it is. Printed by Kalman Steinberg. Okay. So this is basically what we're reading here is a translation of a translation. Because what he translated is, it's a fourth translation really. Because the Kuzri wasn't written in Hebrew, it was translated into Hebrew by Ibn Tibbon. And then Ibn Tibbon's translation was translated by Rav Mordechai Genizi, because it was ancient Hebrew, so about 60 years ago people realized it's hard to read that Hebrew, so Rav Mordechai Genizi translated that into modern Hebrew. And then that modern Hebrew translation was translated into this English translation. So this is the fourth translation. It's a translation of a translation of a translation of the original.
It was translated from Hebrew.
I'm saying translated from Arabic to Hebrew, from Hebrew to Hebrew, from Hebrew to English. So you have to realize that things aren't as accurate as we would like in this translation, and he can't be blamed for it. But that's what you've chosen. I respect that. That's what we'll read. It is related that the king of the Khazars saw in his dream that his intentions were desirable to the Creator, but his actions were not. And he was ordered in his dream to investigate which is the activity which is desired by the Creator. And this is one of the important messages of Judaism, which our Parsha, Parshas Nitzavim, also stresses, that on one hand, God puts great weight on where one's heart is, but on the other hand, that is not enough. And this concept has multiple places where it is expressed in halacha. Person's intentions are very, very important, but it doesn't end there. There are times that the intentions do validate an action that would seem wrong, but those are the exceptions. In general, our assumption is that it's not enough to have good intentions. God says, there's an action that I want, and that's the message that he is getting in his dream. We left it as a question last time, what the message of this is to the common person. We also asked, is the book written for Jews or non-Jews? The simpler understanding of his introduction is that the book is for Jews. And he says, I'm writing Libnei Amenu. He says, I'm writing to the people, to our people. And so the simple understanding is that we have a starting point. The king of Khuzar has to have this miraculous starting point. We offered that maybe the idea of the angel is something which manifests itself in every person's conscience, that inner feeling that says, I'm not where I should be, when a person isn't where he should be. He has turned to one of the philosophers and asked him about his faith, So in our translation, what does he tell the philosopher? Yes. So you'll notice here he asked about his faith. The philosopher's answer was, our opinion is that the Creator is above all desires and aspirations. And the truth is, and Judaism will agree with it, he has neither a will nor hatred. Right? That's Maimonides in the beginning of his work. Maimonides says that wherever the Tanakh says God willed or God was upset, the Tanakh is using humanistic terms to describe God so that we will understand it. And that is also the Talmud. The Talmud says that in multiple places. This is because an aspiration intimates a lack by the aspirant, since before his aspiration is fulfilled, he lacks something which he aspires, and only the acquisition of his aspiration causes him to become perfect. So, that's true. I mean, this goes back to our discussion, our philosophical discussions, was in this class, but it wasn't in the Kuzri class, about the cause of the cause of the cause, about the little boy that asks why. You guys remember that?
Mm-hmm.
We did that. Okay, so to a certain degree, we also say that we start at the second step, meaning the first question of why we don't have an answer to. The second question we do, meaning from our perspective, why did God create a world, why does God want, etc., that we can have. In the same manner, in the opinion of the philosophers, he is too elevated and exalted to know details of matter. So this is where we start differing with the philosopher. The philosopher says God doesn't know details of matters because these change continuously, whereas in the knowledge of the Creator, there's no place for the concept of change. He is a constant. So we agree that he is a constant, and further, we say that one of the great miracles, one of the great gifts that we were given in this world is the Torah, which is a constant. As the Baal HaTanya writes, and so do other sources write, the greatness of the Torah is in the fact that the Torah is a moral code which is consistent for humanity in this world. It doesn't change with the passing fad. We have a tradition of interpretation. We have a tradition of extrapolation. We have a tradition as to the strengths that the sages have to institute new institutions, but that doesn't change the core of the 613 mitzvot. That is because God can give you a moral code. He says, I created the world, I created the human, and I can tell you what's right and wrong. For a human being to invent a code, well, we can invent all kinds of codes, but later generations are going to question that. So we agree that God is consistent, but we disagree with the philosopher and his saying that God is unaware of details. To what degree is God aware of details? So that is a machlokas in the Talmud and in the Midrashim. One medrash says that every blade of grass has an angel telling it grow. So that medrash holds that every blade of grass has its angel, right? So that's why there are stories about many rabbis who were sitting next to the disciple and he was plucking leaves off a tree, and the rabbi looks at him in horror and says, how can you do that? That's going with that understanding. Maimonides expands on this, discussing the different opinions. Do we say that Hashem's Hashgacha is specifically on a species when it comes to animals or plants? Or is Hashem's Hashgacha, is Hashem really watching over every individual plant or animal, etc.? And this is something which is in, there's a machlokas, there's a disagreement among the sages. And for this reason, we, the philosophers, believe that the Creator does not know us, and definitely does not know our intentions and actions, nor does he listen to our prayers, nor does he sense our movements. Now you understand the danger in such a philosophy. If he doesn't know, then he doesn't care, then there's no judgment at the end of the day. Then I'm left to my own whims. I told you guys the story of the great philosopher who sat in this classroom. We had a great philosopher who sat in this classroom, wrote some philosophical works, and to my mind, he was one of the kindest, most moral people I knew. Until I got a phone call from whoever, telling me that his girlfriend's pregnant. So I started pleading, don't abort the baby. I understand it doesn't work with your plans for life, but it's a life. Don't abort the baby. And I started begging, and then I said, you know what? We'll adopt the baby. I haven't yet spoken to my wife, but I promise you, you want to give me a minute, I'll call her. From that time onward, I have a deal with my wife. I don't have to ask her. I have her approval. But that was the first time that I was faced with a situation where they already had scheduled the abortion. So I said, I don't understand all the philosophies, all the kindness you wrote about. So the answers were philosophical, but he knew, and I knew, that they were a farce. He was stopping a human life because it didn't fit his schedule. It wasn't on the agenda. And that's when I suddenly realized what the verse says, what Avraham Avinu tells Avimelech. He tells him, Avimelech asks him, why did you lie? Why did you tell us all she's your sister? We have a legal system here. It's one of the Noahide laws. What'd you lie for? And Avraham tells him, Rak en yirat Elokim b'makom hazeh. Yeah, the only thing you're missing, I understand your legal system should have protected me, but the only thing you're missing is there's no God-fearingness in this place. So yeah, you have a legal system, but there's no God-fearingness here. And if there's no God-fearingness, then you could twist the system. You know, the United States government decided to audit many people here in Israel now. It's one of the moves coming from above, you know, to apply pressure here in Israel. So you think they're auditing us. Okay, it's within a legal system, right? The day you could plead your audit is on September 26th. You know what's that day? Yom Kippur. Mistake, right? Innocent mistake. Didn't it? You know, there's a whole calendar. For sure they didn't mean it. Yom Kippur is the day you could argue your audit with them. Mistake, right? Maybe. Okay, maybe. Rak en yirat Elokim. Avraham Avinu tells him a legal system without God is a system which can be maneuvered. If I don't have to answer up to God, then you can maneuver it, and I'm not safe with my wife. That's why I had to lie. And that's the danger, aside from whether it's right or wrong. The philosopher's approach, well, with such an approach, that's Hitler also had his philosophy. He also had his theories. Philosophy does not ensure morality. And if the philosopher tells you that the Creator has created you, they only use it as a metaphor, whereas the truth is that He is the reason for your creation, because He is the cause of all causes in the creation of all creatures, but no direct action has been taken by Him explicitly in order to create you. There's no personal connection. There's no personal obligation. He doesn't personally care about you. You don't have to personally care about Him, because it doesn't really matter. It is our opinion that the world has existed forever without any beginning, and man who was born from another man that preceded him lived in it forever. And the Creator did not create the creation by an intentional act, but the entire creation emanates from the Creator, may he be blessed. The original cause brought forth from itself the next cause, and the second, the third, the fourth, and so on, and the causes and effects combined into the development that appears to us in natural phenomena. And just as the original cause has existed forever without any beginning, so are the developments of the causes and effects and the laws of nature primordial without a beginning. So, at first glance, it seems illogical. But if you think about it a little longer, then you realize there's a lot of logic to what the philosopher is saying. What's he saying? He's saying, you see a world where man comes from man comes from man. What are you going to tell me now? There's something else that created man? Prove it. Ah, so I'm willing to say there's a creator. There's a creator. There's some kind of cause that's beyond my understanding. There has to be something. Where did it all come from? So what did I do? I took the question mark, turned it into the answer. I had a question mark, where did it all come from? I'm answering you. That question mark is the answer. There's something you don't understand that created everything. Why should I attribute anything else to him? So the philosopher says, I work logically. If man always came from man, and you want to make a starting point, so then that starting point is something you don't understand, right? You don't understand how you could have a starting point that doesn't have a starting point, right? So in essence, we don't differ that much from the philosopher, because we'll also admit that we don't understand God. Or as the philosopher said, quoted also by the Rishonim, if I'd understand him, I'd be him. What does that mean? That means he is beyond my concepts. That's by definition, the first definition of God, something which is beyond my understanding. So I can't understand him. He is beyond reason because he does not fit into reason. Because what did we just say? Reason leads me to a question. What did I do? I said, that question, that thing which is beyond my reason, that's my first definition of God. Fine. We evolve with that definition. But that definition isn't so far from what we're going to say. We're going to say there's something which is beyond our concepts. Ah, if he revealed himself to us, if he tells us that he has traits, okay, so then we know. But if I'm going to have to work logically backwards and come up with something, what I come up with is a question mark. I don't know. Does he care about me? Doesn't he care about me? Does he know me? Is there a morality? I end up with a question. So for someone who's working off of nothing, I think the philosopher reaches the point where you'd reach. They asked Rav Elchanan Wasserman. You guys ever hear of Rav Elchanan Wasserman? He was a big rabbi in Europe, and he perished during the Holocaust. He wrote excellent books on Talmud and Jewish thought, and out of humility, so his works were never published as a work. They're called Kovetz Shiurim, the binder of classes. That's how his book is called. He wouldn't call it a book. It's a binder of classes he gave. Happens to be one of the great works we have from the last century. So he also wrote a book on Jewish thought. And that book also was called Kovetz Haoros, the binder of comments. Like, out of modesty, he never had it written as a book. Now, over there, he discusses what is Judaism's expectation of the man in the middle of a Zulu tribe out in Africa. What do we expect of him? He never heard of Sinai. He never You know, all he grew up with was the pagan beliefs that they have down there. What do you want from him? So he develops over there in his essay that the Torah really expects a person to question. Meaning the Torah expects every person, ask, ask, ask. And we will see that the Kuzri follows the same line. The expectation is question everything. Question. Because your questions are supposed to lead you somewhere. And there he develops how a person is supposed to, through questioning, logically realize that there should be the Noahide laws. I don't know how you can logically deduce you shouldn't eat Eiver Min HaChai. I don't have an answer for that. Meaning one of the Noahide laws is that you can't eat a limb of an animal that was cut off before it died. I don't know how you're supposed to get to that logically. What? Right, but if we're going to go with symbols, then there are many symbols, then maybe I should be a vegetarian too. Saying I don't see why that's more logical than other things. I don't know.
Would it be, you know, if I'm, you know, seeing someone in the street just grab an animal and pull its leg off and...
I hear, but I don't think I see how I would get to it if I didn't have a tradition. I don't know.
Those animals just suffer, I mean...
But then maybe you shouldn't kill it altogether. And maybe you should be a vegetarian. Where do you draw the line? Why is this more logical than something else? I don't know. I don't know. I'm saying we won't go into the details of the law, which basically the meat today is cut up before the animal is really dead. That's what I was told from packaging plans. Before the animal is legally dead by halachic standards, they cut up the meat, and then all the meat that's in A&P is really Eiver Min HaChai. The buyer, the consumer, might not know it, but the non-kosher meat, right? That's what I was told. I don't know if that's true, but about 5-7 years ago, someone came back and said, "You realize all the meat is being cut up before the animal is legally dead, halachically dead." Okay, so what?
I can tell you what a hunter told me about shooting venison. He said that if you don't catch the animal by surprise instantly, and what happens is the adrenaline goes throughout the meat and it no longer tastes very good, it's no longer tender, and all the meat tenses up because they're prepared for an impact and they're like ready to run. It's an effect, it's this medical terminology for what happens. It's the same thing that helps us get away, run faster when we're scared. Right. And so it's much better to hide and catch, kill the animal immediately before it gets that adrenaline going through, and it's much better meat. Also, it's you know, to take care of our fellow creatures is something that many humans have deep sensitivities for. To see another fellow living creature suffering is very terrible. I know some person who would rather, instead of saving the drowning dog or the drowning human, some people would even have a very hard time making the decision between saving the human and the dog. They're both living creatures, and how do we know which one is more psychically developed? I've heard some people say that they would actually save the dog rather than human.
Yeah.
But I don't agree with that, of course, because there's reasons why you shouldn't. But just, I'll stop there.
So that deserves a broader discussion, because if the reason you're saving the human is because of his intellect, then you have to ask yourself, what's wrong? Meaning, if intellect is what defines us as being different from the animals, and the reason I can eat a cow is because it's not intelligent, then maybe I should go eating the retarded people too. Why not? The species is what defines it. I'm just saying, you know. We have to, if we're going to take the soul out of it, and if we're going to take the discernment between human and animal as being just an evolvement question, an evolvement in the evolutionary ladder, so we won't talk about the approach in the days of the Kuzri, where on the evolutionary ladder the black person was in between the animal and the human. We won't talk about that. So then the question was, why was it immoral for them to eat blacks? I'm saying, from their perspective. And if evolutionary theory would make the blacks one step before humans, then maybe we should. I'm saying, going with that theory, I'm just saying, this is where Maimonides writes a small paragraph discussing that human is not a part of the animal kingdom, and we will see the Kuzri will take this, he will expand on it. that this whole idea of, and that's why it's so important. But again, going back to the philosopher, so. Right, but the question is when I have to choose one over the other. We have limited...
You would have to ask a very bad question.
When it comes to that case, there's no way that in real life, I mean, meeting, not talking about it, just like now, if you put it into real life perspective, there's no way that could be a black and white question. And this is in regards to saving any two creatures. So, you know, everything from a human and a dog to a human, or a dog and a dog, or a cat, or whatever it is. You have to take into account, you know, which one, like, you know, do I even have the ability to save one? And which one do I have the higher percentage of saving them all, so keeping myself alive? Am I able to save them both? And if so, what is the best strategy to do so? You know,
so everything you're saying is right. But there are situations where it's very simple. We had here in the hospital 50 years ago, there was an outbreak of some contagious disease in the children's ward. And they didn't have enough vaccines for all the children. Which child gets vaccinated?
Those who are not affected.
They had 500 children who were not affected and were in danger. They had 300 vaccines. Now what? How do you choose which of those 500 get the vaccine? So you'd be surprised. The halacha discusses this. There's a halachic discussion about who has precedence. And the halachic approach is, again, there are, like you said, there are many details. Assuming all things are equal, so I'm not saying halacha lemaisa, I'm not giving halachic ruling, but in general, we have to discern between different scenarios. Before we come back to that question, we have to have a little bit of background. Let's take the following scenario. You have the Chafetz Chaim sitting here, okay? And he's about to write works that are going to affect all of humanity for centuries to come. And he's going to write a work about being a kind person and how to talk and halachic work. And he wrote works that really affected humanity for who knows, yet to be seen. In comes a man and says to him, Mr. Rabbi Yisrael Meir of Radin, you know, I've lived an immoral life. I really regret it, but I don't see myself getting out of it. I've stolen, I've done so many heinous acts. I really, every day I do more terrible things, and I've hurt people. And I'd like to be better. I don't see how I'm ever going to change my lifestyle. And he's sitting there thinking, and he starts pouring his heart out and saying, you know, but I don't see myself changing. I don't see how I could, or if I would, I really know I should, but I don't know. And as they're having this conversation, in walks a man with a gun. He puts a gun to the Chafetz Chaim's head and says, here's the deal. You kill him or I kill you. Pause. What's going on in the Chafetz Chaim's mind, possibly? I have so much to contribute to the world. I have so many good things to do. And him, look at what he's done to the world. What does the halacha say? The halacha says, "My chazis de damach samik tvei." Why do you think your blood is any redder than his? You're a human being; he's a human being. You may not take his life to save your own. So even though the Chafetz Chaim can think of himself as I've got so much to offer the world, and look at what he's doing to the world, we say that doesn't entitle you to take anyone's life. So there's a difference between taking someone's life and saving someone's life. When you have a woman that's pregnant and the baby's endangering the mother and the mother's going to die, so we say the baby is a rodef. Before the baby's born, we say he is endangering her life. If someone is endangering someone else's life, then I may intervene and save that person's life. We have a halacha, we had it a few parshios ago, that if one person is chasing someone else to kill him, you killed the guy who's chasing. But you might say, why should I kill him? Someone's going to end up dead. Why should I intervene? So the halacha says, no, sometimes if someone's trying to murder, you kill the murderer. You don't let him get away with it. You'll say, but wait, maybe it's better if he stays living. Albert Einstein is chasing Joe the drunkard. and he's running after him with a sledgehammer. So we'd shoot Albert Einstein. Ah, he has a lot to contribute to the world. That's true. But at the end of the day, right now, he's trying to murder him. And we stand up and we protect the one. And that could be a mother with a fetus inside, where the fetus is endangering the mother's life. And there will be times where we do say that fetus is not going to be able to continue living because he is going to kill her, ultimately, before he was born. I'm talking about in utero, before being born. So we have to discern between the different scenarios. So we said Chafetz Chaim, we said the hospital. What do we do in the hospital? So in the hospital we say you're not allowed to pass by a child that needs your help to stay living in order to save another child. You take the shots out of the closet, and the first child you hit, you give them the vaccine, and that's how you go on. Yeah? You're not allowed to pass any child. You vaccinate each one as you go along. Wherever you finish, you finished. You did the best you could. But that's the order you're going. So again, I'm skipping over so many details. There are many more details to be discussed. I'm not saying a halachic ruling here. But I'm saying the general approach, the general thought is, in that scenario, you're not allowed to leave a human being behind. Ah, you want to save him, but that doesn't allow you to pass by the kid right here. Yeah?
Where is all of these medical ethics and practices and everything
taught? All over. Where is it taught? Well, you have to learn a lot of halacha.
Huh?
It's written in many places. I mean, the sources for these halachot are in Talmud in Horios, and Talmud in Shabbos, and Talmud in Yuma. It's in many, many places. It's not just one place. You have to be able to put it all together. And you need someone really, really big to come out and say, okay, I've mastered all this and I'm going to give ruling. There was a case of Siamese twins here in Israel where only one of them could live. And there was a question of how you cut them up, which one's going to remain living. Which one is considered the rode? Which one is threatening the other one? Meaning they had one kidney, one heart, the brain was divided somewhere. Whose kidney is it? Which one is threatening the other one's life? Remember we said sometimes we look at it and we say, he's threatening him. So when Rabbi Feinstein had to give ruling on that case, it was a case here in Israel, he locked himself up in a room for 2 weeks straight, going over the sources again and again and again, working his way through it, until finally he came out and gave a halachic ruling. How you decide which one's going to live. You could look it up online. It's a famous case. It was all over the media.
So I just
Google Siamese twins Rabbi Feinstein and you'll see how it was a question of how you cut up the body, meaning they couldn't continue living that way. One would live and one wouldn't. How do you do it? Okay, so that's you can read the response. It's there. The newspapers wrote about it. It was all over. But okay, that's when you have a formula, you have a tradition, you work with it. According to the philosopher, so then there's no connection between us and God, there's no formula. His idea that God is a constant, we agree with. And we say that's one of the great things about the Torah, and that the Torah is a constant. And the Torah's consistency from the days of Moshe Rabbeinu till today. As we said, there is the area that the rabbis have to develop. There are the rabbinic institutions, but at the end of the day, the 613 mitzvot are constant. And that's where we do agree with the philosopher. There is an element of consistency to God. His idea that God has nothing to do with this world, that's where we would disagree with him. Okay, we're going to have to pick up here, but it's not Jim next week.